Welcome to episode 128 of Speak Beastie for January 17th, 2021. I'm Amy.
I'm Jeff.
And I'm Shannon.
Yay! We're all here.
No, you have to say woot woot again.
Okay, woot woot.
I mean, you have to say woot woot for the first time because this is the first time we're doing this because we are experts and we're so good at podcasting and didn't have any technical problems at all.
No, this is not a start over.
No, never. It is an opportunity to revisit a wonderful moment.
Wow.
Except this time,
in our friendship,
Jeff decided that he was going to make sure that he actually hit record.
How are you guys doing? How's life?
Life is,
you know what?
Interesting.
I'm not gonna say what it is because most people know, and if you don't know, you're probably better off not knowing. But there was a thing that happened in the United States this week, and it was not a fun thing. And it's all anyone's talking about, and it makes me feel weird to say, I am doing well, because every time I say that, I think about the thing that happened and think, is it okay that I'm doing well? It's fine that I'm doing well, right?
Yeah,
it is.
Like, things are obviously not good for everybody, but I personally am okay, and that's something to be grateful for.
That's good.
We're here to provide levity and fun. And we've got a nice, fun topic today. We're not talking about, like, World War II or something.
Thank God.
No, we're going to talk about a feel-good romp that happened in between the World Wars, but we'll get to that later.
Fantastic piece. The world... The U.S., really, I should say.
Yeah.
And those in the U.S. who think they are the world.
Yeah.
Not naming names here. We have another, there's another very excellent show called Accio Politics where I'm sure that they will cover that.
Oh, yeah.
Can't wait for those hot takes.
Accio Politics.
Yeah. So, I mean, other than, like, real world news, there's really... no news to talk about for the Phoenix Register.
There is a note from our editor that says we can talk about tacos. I listened to the episode before this one, and I may just be forgetting, but did tacos come up? Is that a reference
tacos
to something?
Tacos come up a lot.
You know what? I'm just going to... I don't remember the names of everybody who was on the episode before this one, but it was a glorious series of tangents, and I don't even remember what they were supposed to be talking about. I just know that there were like 20 different avenues that came off of it, and it was fantastic. I didn't know it was what I needed to hear until I heard it, and I loved it.
Which, speaking of tangents, one of those we got an answer to in our Speak Beastie email. So the owls are going to bring that into us right now.
Okay, make sure that you all keep your windows open for the owls, even though it's cold outside.
Okay, so we got an email... We got an email from Diskid, which we've all agreed we love Diskid.
We certainly
do. Thank you for always emailing us.
The voice of a generation, Diskid.
So the first part of this email explains all about corgis, which I never knew that I needed to know this much about corgis, but now that I do, this is information I will never forget.
I love corgis so much.
What's not to love?
I know.
So Diskid says, well, Speak Beastie, if you're looking for somebody who has answers about corgis, which I believe they were looking for somebody on the last episode, I'm your girl. I've had corgis for much of my life. To sum it up, there are two types of purebred corgis, and they are both Welsh dogs. The Pembroke Welsh Corgi and the Cardigan Welsh Corgi. The difference in them is physical. The Pembrokes either have their tails docked. Of course, this is dying out due to laws against this in many countries/states, or they were born completely without them, like my Winston. That would be my corgi baby. Due to many years of breeding them out of tails, animal evolution at work, whereas Cardigans have a long fox-like tail. Cardigans are also bigger and heavier. On average, a male one will be about 38 pounds, whereas a male Pembroke will on average be 27 pounds, right where my Winston is. We need to meet Winston, and we need pictures of Winston in the next email.
Yes, please.
For our audio podcast.
Yes.
Well, the pictures are for us. I mean, we can share them on our social media outlets with Disc Kids' consent, but even though it's an audio format, the pictures are for us.
It helps us visualize. So Disc Kid goes on to say, Pembrokes also only have three colors. Red, most of the Queen's corgis, tricolor, which is what her Winston is, and sable, which is a little bit of black on the back. Cardigans have more variety of colors, such as brindle and blue merle, along with the colors Pembroke has. And before anyone asks, no, a blue merle corgi is not a real purebred corgi. It is a mixed breed that often gets misadvertised as a rare corgi in order to make an excuse to charge more for it, so watch out for that scam if you want to get one. They're very smart and playful dogs, can be a bit bossy though. They are herding dogs after all. So there you have it, folks. Corgis.
I love corgis. I love herding dogs, too. I used to have an Australian shepherd, and we would be very mean to her, honestly, where we would all, like, run in different directions, and then she would have to herd us back together. But it was, I think it was an enriching activity for her.
Probably.
She really hated it when we were in different rooms of the house. She was like, oh my god, the herd is not together.
You know, I've not actually lived in the same house as a dog for quite some time, but I haven't really missed that feeling so much because several times my wife and I have had occasion to wonder if our oldest cat, Kaname, he is a Maine Coon Siberian mix, and sometimes we get the feeling he thinks he's a dog.
I'm gonna get a dog soon. And I'm very excited.
Yay!
I can't get it yet because I have to babysit my parents' dogs next week.
Oh.
You have to or you get to?
I mean, yeah, I get to. They're very old, and one of them is just the calmest, sweetest dog in the world, and the other one is a husky, and she's crazy. But we love her.
Oh gosh, one of them is a husky. I love to look at huskies, but it was actually, I don't know how this happened, but I started following a YouTube channel at some point in my life called Zeus the Stubborn Husky.
Oh, I love Zeus.
Check out Zeus the Stubborn Husky on YouTube if you have not seen him, because this dog freaks out over everything, and I do not know if this is any indication of what it's like to have a husky. I find it very difficult to wonder, why do people put up with these things? Like, they're precious and they're beautiful and I'd love to have one, but he would probably, or she would probably drive me crazy. On our podcast, where we ask questions, and sometimes there's a question of the week. See, I just segued us back in.
Yay! Yeah. Back on track. So the podcast question of the week in the last episode was, should Aragog be a 4X or 5X rating of how dangerous a beast it is? And this kid also answered the podcast question in addition to giving us all that great info about corgis. And they say, on the question of what level should Aragog be, I think a 4X is appropriate, as 5X means they are so dangerous that a trained professional cannot handle them. I have a hard time believing that was the case with Aragog. As he was not only able to hold back from attacking Hagrid, he was also able to hold his kids back while he was alive. If he were truly a 5X, I don't think he would have the power to resist attacking Hagrid at all. This tells me that he does have the power to be handled by a professional. Of course, one of Hagrid's flaws is that he gives too much benefit of the doubt and doesn't fully comprehend how dangerous these creatures can be. Definitely a professional who is able to accept that the creatures are dangerous would probably be better equipped to handle them. Kind of like Jane Goodall in Gorillas. She loves gorillas, wants to educate the public about them so they're more understood, and is very good with them, but no way would she ever allow a regular person who simply loves gorillas to go near them, as she knows they can be very dangerous unless somebody who is professionally trained is the one handling them. She's not in denial of it because she loves them, unlike Hagrid, who doesn't seem to be able to accept that creatures he loves can be dangerous. Which, truth.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, this comment actually made me think about something that for some reason I had never considered. The ministry rating of X's to determine how dangerous or even sentient a creature can be is meant to generalize for each species, but it doesn't take into mm-hmm. account that some species like the Acromantula have... You have examples like Aragog, who are sort of an exception, because Diskid puts it well when they said that Aragog can hold themselves back and not attack Hagrid, or keep their sons and daughters back and not attack anyone on Hagrid's command. But according to the ministry ratings, the fact that the Acromantula want to attack human beings without Hagrid there to say, hey, please don't eat my friends, is enough to earn them a 5X rating.
Yeah.
It's very interesting that the ministry has this whole classification system, because we don't really have that in real life for real animals.
Right.
No, in real life, what we have are people making YouTube videos of themselves handling animals that people probably should just stay away from for their own safety to prove, hey, you thought you couldn't domesticate these creatures. Well, guess what?
In real life, our highest classification for dangerous animals is just Australia.
Yeah.
Shout out to our Australian listeners, because I know we have them. There are things that we see posted online, and I know it's not representative of what the entire country of Australia is like, but some of the things that I have seen online have made me very, very worried about the kind of animals that I might encounter if I visited Australia. Most likely, it would only be certain parts of Australia, and as long as I avoid those certain parts, then I'm probably fine. Like, as long as I stay within the cities, then I'm probably going to be okay. It's just, I've seen a lot of pictures of ordinary places, fields, and buildings covered in these massive, unthinkable spider webs. And there's spiders all over them.
I am terrified of spiders. Oh. So, like, I already hate just regular spiders. I don't know if I could ever go to Australia.
That's like, it's me and snakes. I can't stand snakes. So, like, I basically can't live anywhere else. Because if I go any farther south, there's gonna be other snakes that I don't want to see.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm good here.
I do okay with snakes for the most part. Most of them, I'm just like, aw, I want to boop the snake on his little snoot. Spiders, no, I have tried. Yes. I have tried to get over my arachnophobia, and it is not going well.
Speaking of my husky, one time my dad came outside to find my husky. This was when they lived in Maryland, to find her just like having a shouting match with a snake. And dad's like, oh my god, she's gonna die.
A shouting match with a snake.
Yeah, she was just howling at it, and it was hissing at her, and it was like...
The impressive thing would have been if the snake was shouting back.
I think they were arguing. I think the snake had some sort of dead creature, and my husky wanted it.
Oh my gosh. You know what? Your husky is a parcel mouth. Dude.
Yes. Oh my god, she totally is.
Your husky is a parcel mouth.
That totally tracks.
Oh, crap. I hope that means your husky's not the heir of Slytherin. We don't need to deal with that again.
She would be.
So, when I was reading this comment, I was kind of chuckling to myself because have you guys ever seen Grizzly Man, the documentary?
No.
No.
Oh, my God. It's basically like real life Hagrid. Because he decides he's going to go live with the grizzly bears and they're like all his friends mm-hmm. and he gives them names. They eat him in the end. But yeah, it's basically like Hagrid. Like he's like, these are my friends. They'll never hurt me. They'll never hurt anybody.
Pump the brakes.
Yeah.
They eat him?
Yes, they eat him.
Did you say this was a documentary or did I imagine that?
It is a documentary. This happened.
And do they put it in a caption at the end that he was eaten by the bears? Or is there actual footage? Because I'm pretty sure that would amount to a snuff film.
Yeah, there's not actual footage. There's an audio tape of it happening, but they don't play the audio tape.
Yeah.
So, like, they know it happened. And, like, they found his remains and stuff. But all the footage is stuff that he took while he was out there with his video camera.
Oh, and it was put together by Werner Herzog.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, it's why? It's something.
Any other animals and death-related things we could talk about?
Yeah, this is getting grim.
Okay, let's round it off with our last response to the question. This is going to be a lighthearted episode. Then, because I like it. It's short and to the point.
Yes. Yeah. So this answer to our podcast question came from an Instagram comment from HaydenBaby05. And they say it should be a 5X because he seems pretty smart and a giant smart spider is terrifying. Which,
that's
yes.
True, that's true.
I think it's just the accent. I think it's just because Aragog in the films is voiced by Meister Pyzel from Game of Thrones. It's a fun bit of trivia out there. I cannot remember the actor's name off the top of my head just now, but Aragog in the Chamber of Secrets film is voiced by the actor who played Meister Pyzel on Game of Thrones. Thoroughly unlovable character, but yeah, he gives a good performance. Actually, they're both thoroughly unlovable characters.
Yeah.
I'd have given Aragog the benefit of the doubt because he didn't ask to be brought into that castle and then taken out into the forest. But sending your kids to eat other people's kids is not cool.
No. I mean, to be fair, Harry isn't someone else's kid. Because he doesn't have parents.
Not too soon.
Oh.
Goodness.
Anyway.
Oh, boy. Anyway. If you...
Lighthearted episode.
Yeah, sure.
Lighthearted. Before we round off the podcast question, I love how both of these inputs, they kind of come from the same place, that Aragog is the exception, but they followed up in different places. Disc Kid says he's the exception to this generalization that giant spiders that can talk are dangerous, so we should give him a 4. But the HaydenBaby05 on Instagram says he's an exception to giant spiders because he's smart and spiders are already scary, so a spider that can think and talk and order mass murder should get a 5.
Yeah, I think I would lean more towards Aragog should get a 5.
Yeah.
But I think these are both very compelling arguments. And I think it does just point to, like, you can't singularly classify a species.
Well, especially one that, like, clearly has an intelligence that they can, you know, like, think things through before acting on it.
Yeah.
Like, how do you classify that, really?
You would have to observe them, and only a handful of people are actually interested in doing that, like Newt Scamander and Hagrid.
And now we transition into my rant about how pit bulls are not inherently dangerous.
Yes. This is true.
Okay, but you have to refer to them all throughout your argument as pitties because they're precious babies, and I love them.
Pitties. Oh, it's so distressing. I'm back on dogs. It's so distressing looking for a dog right now because, especially here in Central Florida, there are so many pit bulls available for rescue, but like no apartment allows you to have pit bulls or Rottweilers, but it's mostly pit bulls that you come across, and it's so sad because I'm like, they're so cute.
They are. They've got those big eyes.
Like, it's kind of like I'm looking on like Pet Finder rescue sites, and it's like 9 out of 10 of them are pit bulls or pit bull mixes.
Yeah.
It's like, but I can't have them. So my parents should adopt them all.
There you go. So anyway, if anyone wants to ever send us owl post, we love to have it. This was great. I'm glad we had some to discuss this episode. And even if you aren't feeling super inspired by the podcast question, if you just want to send us requests or suggestions for topics that you want to hear discussed on future episodes, we would love that too.
We've got so much time to discuss stuff.
Yes.
We promise.
Until those set photos and things start dropping.
Regardless of the topic, we can find a way to tie it in.
Absolutely. I mean, we just talked about corgis, so.
If you want me to do a whole episode about dogs, we have 552 days before we have another movie, so. I guess we probably have like 500 days
God,
before.
God, is it 552? Yeah.
We've got the countdown on our website, speakbeastie.com. So.
Wowza.
That is a sad number.
Yeah.
22.
Yeah. But you can send all of those fun discussion topics to speakbeastie@gmail.com. And Shannon, this is another episode we can just drop the email constantly.
Mm-hmm. speakbeastie@gmail.com. Or you can like tweet at us.
Yeah.
Yes, please tweet at us. Speaking as a... okay, I am now going to put on my hat to be the official representative of the social media team for the day. Our Twitter account, if you're not following it, is super fun. We have everything there. We have fan art. We have memes. We have news on the rare occasions that we get news these days. We send out the podcast question, links to the episode, whenever we have bonus stuff that's out there. We try to make people aware of that. Mm-hmm. It's just such a fun... It's even if I weren't associated with the podcast, I'd be following our account. And I can say that honestly because the
Twitter
stuff we send out,
Instagram.
It makes my day.
And once in a while, we hop on and do something live on our outlets as well. So if you're following, you'll get that
notification.
Yes,
like every other Sunday. I think it's every other Sunday that we don't release an episode. We have the Speak Beastie correspondents doing a live stream on our YouTube channel as well, don't they?
Yeah. Yep.
Fabulous group of people.
Yeah, so
absolutely love
go
them.
Follow all of our social media, basically.
Yes. Stuff ha- it's
it
2021. Stuff happens on social media.
Hashtag do it for Jeff.
Yes, that's a hashtag that is going to get 2 acknowledgments.
All right, well, now we're going to go into our main discussion this week. And so this is an idea. I don't know who originally came up with this idea in our...
Wasn't it yours?
Well, I mean, it was... We have, behind the scenes, we've got like this doc of topic ideas.
Ooh,
so
secrets.
Someone else had put it in there. I don't know who. Shout out to whoever on our team did that. But it's what if. So... Marvel is coming out with a what-if TV show where it's like, what if things had happened differently? So that's kind of what inspired this idea. So we're going to talk about specifically just the first movie, because maybe we'll return to this for the second movie. We're going to talk about a few different things. What if this had happened? What if this hadn't happened? Just a few different scenarios of like, what if things were a little bit different? How would that have changed the course of the movie and the series? So we've each come up with 2 little what if questions. And I think this is going to be fun. So our first one here is, what if Modesty really was the Obscurial?
Which, first of all, my first thought is they could not have made her a Dumbledore. Because her name doesn't start with an A. A Modesty Dumbledore.
That's what's holding her back from being a Dumbledore. Not the fact that there were 3 Dumbledore children and not Sorry. I'm going to try about, to Jeff? Get through this briefly.
Obviously, the fourth child is A Modesty.
A Modesty.
A Modesty.
A Modesty. It's named for her lack of modesty. How you can tell that in an infant, I don't know, but the Wizarding World is a very odd place.
Do you think they would have... I think she would have been Ariana. I know that she would be too young, but, like, also Credence being a Dumbledore doesn't make any sense.
No, right. I'm sorry. There's no way. No way. Credence is not a Dumbledore. That was a lie that was perpetrated by somebody who only knows how to speak in lies and truths that he can twist. It's a lie.
But we theorized that maybe Credence is somehow connected to Ariana's Obscurus, I forget which word refers to the person and which refers
so
to
the Obscurial thing. Is the person and Obscurus is the thing.
Obscurus is the thing. So we theorized that he could be, his Obscurus could be her Obscurus somehow. Yeah. He's the manifestation of her Obscurus or something. I think that theory would make even more sense if Modesty was Ariana.
Yeah, and I'm not going to dispute that one, because the information we actually have on Obscurials is... We don't have a lot of information on Obscurials, so I would be willing to admit that there's some merit to the theory that the Obscurial that exists in Credence is the one that was in Ariana. But if you're going to put something out there like that and say this is how Obscurials work, I'm going to need at least a solid minute and a half to 2 minutes of film where you make a case for why that fits.
Yeah, I think it's
interesting.
And
that's not on me to make sense of it. That's on the writing staff to make sense of it. If they want to do it that way, fine, but they need to make it work.
I think it's interesting that we do have the two words, one for the thing, one for the host, which very much makes it like it's two separate things, which, like, why do that if there's not a distinction?
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of like, oh, it's a parasite that grows from a I guess you could kind of think of it as, like, the bacteria that grows inside your body that is not you, but is also part of you. But...
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking about the differences and similarities between an Obscurius living in another person and the part of a person's soul living inside a Horcrux. There's something there. I'm gonna let that idea marinate, and then we can come back to that in another episode. That might actually be a thing we could talk about.
Yeah. I think it's interesting we all went there with the Obscurius and the Dumbledore family thing, because I was thinking, if Modesty was the Obscurial, would Albus really be that interested in finding her? Because if we're going with this Dumbledore connection, right? But then my mind goes to, okay, he doesn't actually care about finding Credence, so maybe he would care just as much because it's the Obscurus itself that he's interested in that has the Dumbledore connection. The host doesn't necessarily matter.
We don't really know. If Credence is a Dumbledore, if that's true, we don't know if Dumbledore knows that. Or if Dumbledore has any idea of that.
Of course, he doesn't have any idea because it isn't
it's
true.
Not true. I do think, like, ultimately it wouldn't change the story that much if she was the Obscurial. I think, you know, everybody would still kind of be after, at least, like, Grindelwald would still be after this powerful force. I guess it just kind of, if Grindelwald was still, like, using Credence to find the Obscurial, which I think he would still be doing that, then he wouldn't have that, like, relationship with Modesty. So I guess that would kind of be a big thing that would change the course of... It would change the climax of the first movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it would change how the second movie goes. But I think... I like the idea of, like, Credence on a little adventure with his little sister protecting her.
Yeah.
For the second movie.
Very much. Yeah, I definitely think that Credence would still play a large role in the films because we did see that protective
big brother relationship. So how's he going to go about doing it then? Because if he doesn't have his obscurial powers, does he still have his magic powers? So if he's going to go off on a wayward journey to try to rescue his sister, the obscurial, then how's he going to manage that? He has no resources.
Well, Jacob.
I guess I was imagining he, like, finds her already and then they're just, like, together. But that's true. Like, he'd have to, like, go find her. I mean, we don't even know where she is now.
Okay, right. So I think I see what you're getting at then. Like, it's the two of them against the world. He tries to use whatever street smarts he has to find ways of finding them food and shelter. And if anybody gets too close to them, she uses her obscurial magic and kills them. And he keeps saying, no, no, modesty.
Heck yeah.
You can't keep doing this. You have to learn to control it.
I mean, a little bit like what he and Nagini have going on in the second movie, except better storyteller.
Yeah.
Because I would have liked to see more of Credence and Nagini doing stuff.
Honestly, I just need more Ezra Miller.
Yeah.
Ezra Miller is fantastic.
So I guess this is one of those what-ifs where I'm like, I don't think it would, like, be better or worse for the story.
Yeah. I think we'd still find ourselves in the same place in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be the same and yet different. Because when I see Dumbledore trying to be so compassionate towards Credence, I actually see him trying to fit... I don't know if other people have thought of this, but I see him trying to fit Credence into this kind of substitute younger brother sort of role in his head, because he and his own younger brother had a huge falling out. At the point where these movies take place, they are nowhere near a reconciliation. But he sees another wayward young man who needs help and who's misunderstood by others, and he wants to save him.
Well, to that, I think he would see Ariana in Modesty.
Exactly.
Yeah. Even if there
sees
wasn't
a girl who needs his help in a similar way, then it would be even stronger, because he would actually, he might even look at her and not even see her. He might actually see his younger sister, because she would be, I think, almost even about the right age.
The right age, yeah.
Yeah.
I do think that, to your point about him kind of, like, maybe using Credence as, like, a pseudo-relationship with Aberforth, I also think Dumbledore would see himself a lot in Credence, as just, like, this young man tempted by power. This young gay
seduced
man.
Seduced by Grindelwald.
So I think he could relate to him a lot in that way. But we don't know. I don't think, like, Modesty would end up in the same situation with Grindelwald as Credence does.
Yeah.
Probably not the same exact situation, but that's the thing about Grindelwald that I think this argument has been made before that makes Grindelwald actually a more successful, maybe not in what he actually accomplished, you could debate that, but in terms of being a successful villain in how he's written, Grindelwald is more successful than Voldemort because he's better at taking the time to understand his enemies in order to manipulate them instead of just constantly having to dominate them. So if he was able to understand Credence well enough to know how to manipulate him, he could have done the same with Modesty. It just would have been a matter of how he went about doing it.
And I guess Modesty, you could argue, is a bit more naive just because she's a child. So maybe she would just kind of go with the first person who is nice to her, unlike her mom, her fake mom. I mean, also, though, like, we know that she remembers her real family and was trying to go after them. So there's that, too.
Yeah, that was kind of the other thing I was thinking, is Grindelwald is able to manipulate Credence so well because Credence has no idea where he came from, whereas Modesty might be more challenging in that way. He'd find a different tactic.
I mean, I guess part of, like, Grindelwald's ultimate tactic to getting credence is being like, I know your background. So I think he could kind of do the same thing with Modesty, where he could be like, I can help you find your real family. And then not do it, but like...
Yep, she's a little kid. I would buy that.
Yeah.
What if number two?
Yeah. So the next one is, what if they had included Jacob's original plotline of the fiancé? So for anybody who doesn't know or doesn't remember, there was originally a plotline where Jacob had a fiancé at the beginning of the movie who broke up with him because he didn't get his loan for his bakery. So I don't know, he couldn't provide for her. And so it was actually filmed, but deleted. So yeah, what if they had kept that in?
I honestly kind of wish they did, because I feel like the Jacob and Queenie romance needed more obstacles. It was just very, like, between the first and second films, like, oh, hey, yeah, we're together now. Like, I don't know. Maybe just in comparison with the slow burn of Tina and Newt, it just seemed too much, too fast.
Yeah, yeah, but, I love me some Jacob and Queenie, and I love them as a couple, but I was peeved when they went from, hey, maybe he remembers her, maybe he doesn't, to, oh, by the way, she put a memory charm on him and they got married. Confetti, yay! No, I wanted to see that moment. Thank you.
Yeah.
I do. I guess my main problem with the fiancé storyline is it was like she looked like Queenie from like
the... Why is that a problem?
One image we have. Well, it just seemed... Then it's, I think it would seem more like he's just kind of picking the next girl who looks
he's
like her.
He's got a type.
Yeah, but if
I'm not saying people should or shouldn't have a type, but it might have made sense for his character, because Jacob's he's a good guy, but in some ways he's kind of a typical, you know,
guy.
Cis heterosexual man of the 1920s.
Yeah, I think... that just might have maybe made him seem more shallow. But, like, I guess if she hadn't necessarily looked like just a copy of Queenie, then it would be different. But also, like, we don't know exactly how that plot line did play out in the deleted scenes, because we don't have, like, a script or the scenes.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
They could have built that into the film, I guess, because they could have made that part of the story. Oh, he likes Queenie because he has a type. She fits his type.
Yeah.
But then they go off on these adventures together and he finds out there's so much more to her. And then he has this moment of personal growth where he thinks, you know what? I've always chased after the same kind of person because they fit every criteria on my list. They checked every box. But apparently, real love takes something more. And that's why I never had these kind of feelings until now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But at that point, it becomes much more about the love story between the two of them than it does Fantastic Beasts and Where They Might Be Found. And there's already enough criticism of the franchise for not focusing on that.
Yeah. I do feel like it was kind of a missed opportunity to even make Jacob even more sympathetic. Like, he obviously already is. But I think... they could have not just had the fiance break up with him because of the loan for the bakery, but you could have gone off the very real situations of maybe he came back from war and she'd already moved on. She didn't wait.
Yeah.
Which happened a lot. So that could have made you feel more for him and added that extra layer, I feel like.
Yeah, I definitely feel like if they'd kept the fiance storyline, it would have needed to be more than just this presumably one deleted scene.
Yeah.
Like, to be really interesting. But I mean, yeah, we don't know how much she might have come up later in the movie had that been kept in. But yeah, it could have been interesting. And then you would have had Jacob, like, falling in love with Queenie, but also, like, still kind of getting over this breakup. And so, yeah, maybe they wouldn't have gotten together as quickly. Or even, like, maybe they would have gotten back together, but then part of the conflict in the second movie would have been him being like, I'm not ready to get married yet. Like, I just went through this thing with my last fiance.
Yeah.
Like 2 days ago. Yeah. All right, next one.
Yeah.
So this is a good one. What if Queenie wasn't a Legilimens?
I'll admit, both of the what-ifs that I submitted, I get a bit hung up on Queenie, and I think it's because I just love her so gosh darn much. She's so sweet and so fun, and just the kind of person that I would want to be best buddies with if these people were real and I lived in the same world they did.
Yeah, she's a very interesting character. That's why we talk about her all the time. And I think this is a very interesting question because I do think it kind of brings up, like, how much does her being a Legilimens matter to the plot versus how much does it matter to her character? Because really, like, her being a Legilimens doesn't affect the plot that much.
Not really. I mean, there's the moment where she's wandering around Paris and she can't tune out other people's thoughts, and she's sitting in the street, poor dear, and she's completely freaking out and she's upset. And I expect it, when we had that moment, I was surprised that that was the first time that that had happened. Like, I wondered why haven't we had that happening more?
I think it would certainly have happened more to her in her life. I really like that moment. I think that's one of the best parts of the second movie, is kind of seeing the downside to this power. And I think it's certainly safe to say that, like, her power is why Grindelwald is so interested in her.
Yeah.
True. So, in focusing on the first movie.
Yes, yes.
I'm thinking it has more to do with her character, definitely, than it does with the plot. Yeah. I always kind of felt, especially the way she goes about doing it, because she just jumps right into, oh, these are total strangers who never met before, and one of them is a nomad. I'm just going to walk right up to him and demonstrate the fact that I can hear everything that he's thinking, and it won't bother him at all. But that made me think she's a bit shy in relating to people sometimes, and simple in the good way, just because she's got this very calm, easygoing nature. So maybe the use of this power is her way of trying to make it easier to interact with others. Like, there's a very Luna Lovegood, like, quality about Queenie.
Yeah. Yeah, and I definitely think, like, if you grow up like that, where you can hear other people's thoughts, you are gonna interact with people in a different way and be more comfortable with them in some ways and be less comfortable with them in other ways.
Yeah, I always kind of wondered on the flip side of that if being a Legilimens is what actually has made her more shy, because I feel like that would also be very isolating. And that, you know, people can't relate.
That is a brilliant point, because she can hear people's thoughts all the time, but she can also hear what they're saying, and so she knows better than almost anybody just to what extent people are dishonest.
Yeah.
And it's probably affected her ability to trust people. Unless she proves to them, hey, you can't lie to me, buddy.
Yeah.
I know you prefer strudel over pie.
Or what they think about her, which could be very damaging mentally.
Yeah.
And she says that, but it's always kind of bothered me a little bit. The line where she says, oh, it's okay. Most guys think what you was thinking when they first see me.
Yeah.
That is not okay.
It's not. But that's, I mean, it makes sense that, like, she would have to deal with stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's like she's just learned to shrug it off. She gets objectified when she goes out. And it's also, I guess you could also interpret that as they're not just checking her out and thinking, ooh, baby, I'd love a piece of that. They're looking at her and thinking, oh, she's a blonde bimbo. She probably doesn't have two brain cells to rub together. That's still not cool.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Queenie, I love you so much.
I know.
I can't help myself.
She's been through so much. I think also, I think in terms of, like, the plot of the movie, in a lot of ways, like, her being a Legilimens just helps speed things up. Like, it mm-hmm. speeds up her whole introduction with them, because she just kind of instantly knows what kind of people they are. It probably makes her, like, manipulating Abernathy a little bit easier. Like, she just knows. I mean, she also knows Abernathy from a personal point because they work together, but also she knows what he's thinking, and she's just like, it's ladies' things. I know we're going to get to that again in a moment.
Yeah, so I say, put a pin in Abernathy because I wanted to make sure that there was at least one what if on the list that was just pure fun that we could have a good laugh about, and I made sure to throw in stupid buttface Abernathy.
Yeah, we'll get there.
I don't have any feelings about Abernathy. It's fine.
Yeah, I think he's fine.
He doesn't help out in insurrection and free magical Hitler from jail. It's fine.
I thought I saw Abernathy on TV the other night.
Too soon.
In what?
Oh, God.
Anyway.
I do think in terms of plot, it is used quite a bit to move the plot forward. And
yeah.
I think the writers would struggle in getting this movie to go forward without that. Because obviously in the first film, you know, that's how she knows that Tina and Newt and Jacob are captured in Makusa. So yeah. They would mm-hmm. either still be in that cell or have drowned in the memory pond thingy. So,
yeah, it's like everything in the first movie could have still happened. Like, they could have still, you know, escaped or whatever. But it just would have taken longer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and of course she had to get what's his name to go away by not so gently implying that she knows about his affair.
Yeah.
I also was thinking about how I think we assume, because of the dynamic of their relationship as far as what we do see, that Tina has been protective of Queenie probably for a lot of their life, especially mm-hmm. since the death of their parents. But I think that sometimes in turn, when you have that kind of sibling relationship, makes the one who's being protected want to be protective of the other sibling.
Yeah,
so right. I've sometimes wondered if Queenie hasn't occasionally been protective of Tina because she knows that she's been hurt and how she's been hurt, because she could probably hear her sister's thoughts as well as anybody's. And so I've been thinking, if she wasn't a Legilimens, she might have questioned the relationship that starts to blossom in the first film between Newt and Tina, because she can hear what's in Tina's head. She can hear what's in Newt's head. So she knows a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit of what Newt has been through. But even though she has trouble with Brit's accents, she learns a little bit about Newt and what happened with Leta Lestrange, and it makes her empathetic towards him and thinks, oh, you need a giver. Guess what? I have a sister who's one of those, honey.
Yeah, it's true. We wouldn't have gotten quite as much Leta set up had she not been able to read his mind. You know, she still could have been like, who's this picture of this lady? But yeah, I think this would change the second movie a lot more, obviously, as we kind of touched on. But yeah, in the first movie, it's like, I think it would just kind of slow things down and it would make her a little bit different of a person. But I like the person she is, except for the joining wizard Nazis. That's a problem, but see how that goes. Ready for the next one?
Ready.
Yes, please.
What if Abernathy had wanted to take a peek at Queenie's ladies' things?
I wrote that, and then I read it back. If anybody reads that who does not have context for it, like, if I was writing that, I was picturing this scenario where I'm in a coffee shop and I'm working on notes for the podcast show, and I'm just referencing a scene where she has the suitcase and she says it's full of ladies' things. You want to take a peek? I don't mind. But no, if he wants to take a peek at Queenie's ladies' things, that could be,
yeah, that sounds,
oh gosh, that
so
could
much.
Be so terribly misinterpreted.
Like, he wants to take a peek at Queenie's tampons. I don't know what they used in the 20s, but
I think it was still I think they called it by the same names, but I don't think that they were anywhere near as well developed. But I am not the expert on that.
That will be the next time, Turner. Oh, I found an article
about it. Yeah, that'll be the next time, Turner. I'm definitely interested in this now.
Oh, yeah.
Jeff's like, I don't need to be on that episode.
I don't mind being on that episode, but at that point, I will take a step back and be here to learn, not educate. So, getting back to taking a peek at Queenie's ladies' things.
Yes, you have a list here. What might have happened?
I have a very short list here, and other people can add to it. These are three quick options that if Abernathy had instead been like, hey, I need to take a look inside that case, or if he'd said, she said, do you want to take a peek? I don't mind. And he'd said, sure, okay. So option number one, Queenie walks up to Abernathy and whacks him upside his head with the case and then makes a run for it, which would have been great physical comedy. And it would have been an echo back to the beginning of the movie when Jacob whacks Newt in the head with the suitcase and then runs away.
It would have been great.
So then they both would have had that in common. Aw, you had to whack somebody with a case to get away too, honey.
Made for each other.
Definitely. Matched in heaven. Option two. Newt or Tina pops out of the case when he opens it, hits him with a stunning spell, or even better, Jacob gets to punch him in the face. A lot of these involve Abernathy getting physically hurt.
Yeah.
Which in the first movie, I would have felt slightly bad for him.
Yeah.
But knowing what we know now about where this is going with Abernathy, I would feel less bad seeing it.
I just picture just a fist like appearing out of the suitcase.
Out of the case. Just
disembodied arm.
And then Queenie's like, oh no, I don't know what happened. I'll get a doctor. And then she quietly slips away.
Sorry, Mr. Abernathy. This case packs a real punch, honey. So then option number three. This is not what I originally wrote. He gets pulled into the case, and then he gets placed under heavy guard by an irrumpant in heat.
I think that's
when
really
I wrote that the first time, funny. I wrote by a horny irrumpant, and then I felt weird writing it, so I changed it.
It does have horns. That's very funny.
I love it.
Now, all of these, of course, would have caused security issues.
Probably, but wizards are not good at security.
Yeah, it's true. Might have just caused a few more problems for them, but...
I mean, the little, like, clock thing inside Makuza is already at emergency, right?
So, yeah, how much worse can I get?
What's a few more?
So, any other fun, creative ideas about how they could have handled the situation if Abernathy had wanted to take a peek inside that case?
I think you've covered it.
These are three great options.
I didn't mean to cover all of them.
Well, maybe,
it's
you know...
These are things that came to mind.
If she could have switched it to, like, you know, no matches, then it would have just been Newt stuff, and he would have been confused.
Okay, now option four, he hits the switch, and then he sees just a scarf and stuff, and then he goes to close the case, and he almost hits the switch and says, hey, what's this? She closes the case on his fingers, and while he's going, ah, gosh, darn it, then she runs away.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Abernathy. Yeah. Who'd have been like, Queenie is carrying a case full of men's clothes. Queenie, who are you seeing? Who's not me?
Hey, how do you know the clothes aren't hers?
I mean, yeah.
I'm down. I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah, maybe Queenie they switch to, like, whoever's carrying it. Who knows?
Yeah, who doesn't love a woman in a nice sharp suit?
I think if it switched to whoever's carrying it, that would be too easy for Wizarding World.
That would be a little bit too convenient.
Security.
That would be Deus Ex suitcase.
Shall we go to the next one?
Yes.
Okay. What if Tina had not been at the bank at the same time as Newt and Jacob? So Newt and Jacob still have their whole thing, but Tina is not there to catch Newt.
Like, what if the hot dog vendor had been running extra slow that morning and it had taken her an extra minute or two to get her hot dog?
Yeah. Or maybe the second Salemers weren't there, so she wasn't there.
Maybe if they were staging their little demonstration somewhere other than a bank.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, where else would they go?
I don't know, town hall.
I suppose.
I'm sure they go plenty of places.
Yeah, I feel like it was established, though, that the bank is probably a pretty common place for them to do that, because all different kinds of people, like, they don't just want to get government people to listen to them. They want all different kinds of people, and all different kinds of people of varying, you know, levels of income and influence. They all have to go to the bank at some time or another.
True.
Yeah.
But no, what if Tina had to stand in line one more minute to get that hot dog?
Yeah, so she
or
didn't.
Or what if Tina was a vegetarian and didn't eat the hot dog?
Well, Jacob's memory would have been wiped sooner because she wouldn't have stopped it.
For sure.
That's true.
The movie would have been a lot shorter.
Well, but their cases still would have been switched.
Yeah.
So, at some point, Newt would have realized his case had been switched.
She might have missed a lot of the finer points, but I guess you could say, even if she'd been delayed because her hot dog wasn't cooked long enough yet, then I guess you could say she might have missed some of the finer points of what went on in the bank. Not that she gets the whole story, but she could have, I guess, still caught up to them, because she could have just happened to be walking by the alley, looked down it, and seen Newt pulling out a wand and pointing it at some guy, and be like, no, you can't draw that here. Of course, then she walks right up to him and disapparates to a few feet away. Like, nobody's going to notice that.
Well, I think it's very possible if she hadn't come across them at all, and, like, you know, Jacob had gotten away from Newt, but their cases had been switched, the beast would have still escaped, and Newt would have still realized this. And had to go after Jacob. But it's possible that, like, a different aura would have come to the scene.
Yeah, I was just going to say, do you really think Makusa would have noticed otherwise? They all kind of seem incompetent and preoccupied.
They're a little busy doing nothing. So it's I think it's very possible that it would have just been Newt and Jacob running around the city. And then, you know, possible they would have just still run into Tina at some point.
Well, if they'd done it that way, then I guess you could say that it still would have been an entertaining film, because if we hadn't ever gotten to meet Tina and Queenie, then we couldn't have missed what we never had. But at the same time, now that I know that they exist, I find it troubling to picture a world where they're not there.
You'd also have, like, zero female characters.
And Tina is the connection to the second Salemers.
Yeah.
And therefore the connection to Credence and Grindelwald. So
true. She could have picked the case. You could also say somebody else would have picked up Newt, brought him to the Ministry for processing. She could have overheard what was going on while she was doing whatever she's supposed to be doing in the wand permit office at Makusa. And then she says, oh, wait a minute. I could crack this one. I could round up those critters and bring them in. And then I'd be a total hero. So she smuggles him out and says, look, I need to find those critters because I need to earn my credibility back. And I don't know how to find them, but you do. So you're going to help me find them. And then I'm going to get my job back, or I'm going to put you in the creepy lake that kills you with your own memories.
Well, I think if he hadn't run into Tina at all, maybe he didn't get, you know, arrested at all or anything, the whole story with Credence would have still played out, and with Grindelwald. And so then at the end, Credence would have started, like, destroying the city, and Newt would just have no idea what's going on with this Obscurus thing. I guess he would have, because as we learn later, Dumbledore sent him there to find the Obscurus, whatever. But he would have had a lot less information. And then he probably still would have met Tina because she would have been like, yeah, I've been keeping my eye on this kid. And it's my case. There's a lot of different ways this could have gone.
Yeah.
True.
But it wouldn't be the same movie if Tina and Queenie weren't in it at all.
No.
Which leads me into my last what if scenario, which is what if Tina didn't have a sibling? So essentially, what if Queenie didn't exist?
Then Tina would be lonely.
Oh, yeah.
And sad, because Tina does not have time for love and romance. She's a workaholic. And so the only kind of really human bond that she has is with her wonderful sister, who I love so very, very much.
They would have all been eating hot dogs for dinner.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Jacob probably would have been thrilled. Can you imagine she puts this giant tray of hot dogs in front of them and Newt's just looking at it like, I don't understand what I'm looking at. Jacob's just looking at it like, you mean I can have as many as I want?
I think Jacob would have taken over the kitchen and made himself some baked goods, too.
He would have had to make his own strudel.
Yeah.
I think my answer to this is almost the same as if Queenie wasn't a legilimens. That so much in the plot would change if Queenie wasn't in it. Just like we were just talking about Tina and how she's the connection to Credence and therefore the second Salamers and Grindelwald and how it all connects. I think we'd run into the same things if Queenie was no longer here. Especially moving forward, I think she's going to be such a big part of what drives the plot, having one sister on each side of things. Yeah. I think that will be really important.
Well, and like we touched on with the Queenie being legilimens, it's like they would have had to get out of Makusa a different way. Which I think, you know, the plot still would have found a way, but it would have been more difficult. And not as fun.
Nope.
And then it's like Jacob wouldn't have this, you know, solid connection to the wizarding world. He probably would have never, like, remembered again because he wouldn't have had her to jog his memory.
Very true. Jacob, can you imagine if Newt walked into the bakery and saw all these baked goods that look like his creatures, and then he tries to do that smile that only Alison Sudol can do?
Jacob's just like, why is this weird guy looking at me?
Not that Eddie Redmayne isn't absolutely enchanting, he is, but that smile is just the perfect way to end that film.
Because she's so cute.
With her little pink hat. Oh, I love.
I know.
Her outfit at the end of that movie, oh my gosh, we need to do a whole episode about, has there been an episode about Colleen Atwood? Because if not, we need to do a Colleen Atwood episode.
That costume, it feels like we've probably done a whole episode about coats.
Right? Oh yeah, there was definitely a coat episode.
We could do another one, we can circle back.
Like branch out and do a whole episode about Colleen Atwood in general, because my gosh, there is so much to talk about with her. Her work in costume design is extraordinary. She is
a costume design book.
What Rick Baker was to makeup before he retired.
Mm. Yeah. I just want like a coffee table book.
Fun fact,
of
Rick
all
Baker
her
and Colleen Atwood worked together on How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Really? I didn't even realize that.
Oh, yeah. I've watched the bonus features on How the Grinch Stole Christmas more times than I can count, and the two of them are absolute creative geniuses.
Hmm.
Yeah. But I think it's possible that Jacob maybe eventually would have, like, remembered, but he wouldn't have kind of known how to get back to the wizarding world because Newt would have been in England.
Right.
True. He would have, I think, been fascinated by the existence of magic and of the creatures themselves.
Yeah.
And he still would have probably had his I want to be a wizard moment, but it's not just the wanting to experience the magical world. It's the fact that there's this person in the magical world that he's never felt the same way about anybody before that really keeps pulling him into it. Even when things get difficult and dangerous, she's really his motivation to want to stay a part of this.
Yeah, and it's like, I feel like, you know, I guess if we're kind of looking at between the first and second movies, I feel like he would have been still kind of pursuing the magical world, but it's like he wouldn't have really been able to get there without her, and he wouldn't have had as much motivation to get there. But he was also, you know, in a way kind of content when he walked into the rain, kind of content to know that, like, he got to experience this, even if he's not going to remember it.
Yeah.
So maybe he would have also been a bit more like, well, I got to experience that, and I thought I'd forget it all, but I didn't. But, you know, it was just, it's nice to know that it happened. So, yeah. And then, I mean, yeah, for the future of the movies, if Queely wasn't there, things would be different. So that wraps up our main discussion. I guess if anyone has any more what-ifs they would like us to discuss in future episodes, send them in.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll do a couple more of these, or other hosts can do them with different what-if scenarios. You want to take us to the time turner?
Yes, I would really love to do that. So everybody, make sure you've got the chain securely fastened around your neck, and I think it's 3 turns should do it. It's 3, right?
That's to go back 3 hours.
Okay, I don't know how many turns it's going to take us to get back to the 1920s, but here we go.
A few times should do it, love.
So, this episode releases on January 17th, 2021, which is the 101st yes. anniversary of the date that Prohibition officially took effect in the United States of America. So, we are going to talk about Prohibition for today's Time Turner, a feel-good romp if ever there was one. So the 18th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution prohibiting the, quote, manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors for beverage purposes, remember those words because it's going to come up later, is ratified by the requisite number of states on January 16th, 1919. It officially took effect 1 year and one date after that. So it was officially on January 17th, 1920 that Prohibition began. The movement for prohibition of alcohol actually began in the early 19th century, which is when a lot of Americans who were concerned about the effects of drinking began forming what they call temperance societies. And temperance societies, I've learned, are exactly that. They are groups of people who have banded together to try to take action because they're concerned about the effect that alcohol will have. And the language I found on some of these temperance societies, a lot of them, they focus specifically on the effect that it can have on women, children, and families. So it's very, very patriarchal, this language, because it implies that it's okay for men to drink as long as they are not drinking to the point that they are hurting women, children, or their families. It doesn't say a thing about their health. At least not that I've been able to find. But by the late 19th century, these temperance society groups had become a powerful political force in the United States, so they started off by campaigning on the state level for greater tolerance and, or not tolerance, but abstinence from intoxicating liquors. And then once they started to gain momentum there, they started moving on to a national level. And in December of 1917 is when the 18th Amendment, also known as the Prohibition Amendment, was passed by Congress and was sent to the states for ratification. So we've already established that it took, even after they had officially ratified that amendment, it took a year and a date for that to take effect. Mm-hmm. So Congress took action to try to enforce prohibition in the meantime, while the constitutional amendment was still in the works. So about 9 months after they ratified the Prohibition Amendment, Congress passed what's called the Volstead Act, or the National Prohibition Act, in spite of the veto that the act received from President Woodrow Wilson. The Volstead Act was named after Andrew Volstead, who was a Republican congressman from the state of Minnesota. And if you've never seen Andrew Volstead, I know I hadn't before I put this information together, you should look him up because he has a fabulous mustache. His political affiliations and whatever else he might have done or stood for in his career notwithstanding, I can't help it. I appreciate a good mustache, and he had one.
I looked, yeah. That is a good mustache.
So the Volstead Act provided for the enforcement of prohibition, including the creation of a special unit of the U.S. Treasury Department, and it stayed in effect until the ratification of the 18th Amendment officially took place. So the nation officially becomes dry on January 17th, 1920, and despite a vigorous effort by law enforcement agencies, the Volstead Act largely failed to prevent the large-scale distribution of alcoholic beverages and actually led to a flourishment of organized crime in America. And then prohibition goes into effect. It's not really being enforced on a national level, or it is, but in some states, they're really not doing very much. It's one of those situations where it becomes a law, so yes, it is illegal, but if people responsible for trying to stamp it out see it happening, are they going to turn the other way and pretend they don't see it? Most likely. And that's one of the fun facts about prohibition that I have coming. But to just kind of round off a general description of what happened during prohibition, in 1933, the 21st Amendment of the Constitution was passed and ratified, which repealed prohibition. So this was a constitutional amendment that was in effect officially for about 13 years, a little bit more than that if you count the couple of months that the Volstead Act was in effect before prohibition became official. But it was one of those moments in American history where they went to a great deal of effort to pass a law, and it really, in the end, it didn't end up doing as much good as people thought it was going to.
Yeah, seems legit.
I'm not sure how much this may be a universal concept, but I've always kind of felt like if there is one thing you want, if there is one way to absolutely guarantee that somebody will make more money doing something you don't like, it is to make it illegal. Because yeah. You're not going to stop people from doing something that can make them money, and by making it illegal, you're just making them work harder to get it done, and they're going to become richer in the process unless they get caught, because if they're doing something illegal that they have to keep secret, that means they are not paying what?
Taxes!
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Oh.
So really, they just made the, what was it? Oh, the manufacture, sale, and transportation of intoxicating liquors for beverage purposes. They made it more profitable.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they also made those really cool speakeasies that you can still find around places. So that's one good thing that came out of it, is these really cool secret rooms.
Bars came out of that as well. That's sort of mixed into my list of fun facts about prohibition, is the term dive bar is still very much used. It implies something a little bit different, because the term dive bar was literally that. You had to dive into the ground to get there. The entrances were actually down usually a flight of stairs, because the establishment itself was either underground, or it was in the basement of a building. So the term dive bar is still used, but dive bars these days are in no way illegal. A lot of there's even a show called Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. And what really makes it I think I may be wrong, and I hope one of our listeners will set me right if I am, but I think part of what makes it a dive bar these days is that instead of just drinking, there's a greater emphasis on also serving bar food. Am I right about that?
I don't know.
As far as we know.
I thought it was just like a not as nice bar.
Yeah, that's kind of, yeah. When I hear dive bar, I just think of kind of sketchy.
Well, dive bars in the 1920s were certainly sketchy, but that's because they were against the law. So there was probably all kinds of illegal things going on in there. But getting back to prohibition, I have a couple of fun facts that I wanted to throw in here. So I had mentioned the formation of temperance societies to try to stamp out the use of alcohol. Some groups, such as the American Temperance Society, the Anti-Saloon League, and the Women's Christian Temperance Union, had attempted to push prohibition laws before this, and they were successful in the state of Maine, which is why when other states began to follow suit in passing similar laws, they referred to them as Maine laws, even though they were ultimately repealed because of widespread opposition and riots. I had never heard that term
I was
before.
Like, I'm nodding, and then I remembered it's a podcast.
We can't see you.
So there was also, this one was actually one of my favorites. Dry advocates used World War I to further their cause by arguing that the barley that was being used to make beer would be better served to make bread to feed American soldiers and Europeans that were being affected by the war.
I am always down for more bread.
I like so bread.
I moved towards gluten-free bread, and I'm pretty sure that that's not the kind of bread they're talking about.
Yeah.
But this seems to me like one of those things that they make a real argument and then they start using it, but then when they actually get a look at the numbers and they see what it would cost to really kind of move into implementing this idea, they change their mind and say, ooh, if we just say we did this, is anybody really going to check? It's 1920. We don't have Google. Things aren't electronic yet. They're not going to know. So then I mentioned before that the language used in describing prohibition was important, and this is why. Prohibition made manufacturing, sale, and transportation of intoxicating liquors illegal, but it was not technically illegal to drink it. I think I did say for beverage purposes, but to say for beverage purposes means you're just drinking it because you need something to drink or because you want something to drink. And later on in my list of fun facts, I have some examples of why else you might drink things like whiskey.
Yeah, this is like very failed legal language. This is not direct at all. Like if the issue is people loopholes. Drinking too much of it, wouldn't you just say, hey guys, it's illegal to drink it. Like, why manufacturing, sale, like, transportation?
You can't make it, you can't sell it, you can't move it. But if you have it, I don't know where you got it from, but...
Do you know, I had I was having dinner with a friend, and they had brought another friend of theirs who was in law school at the time. I don't know if they finished, but they were in law school at the time. And what they really... I don't even remember how this came up, but at some point they said, you know what? There isn't much that you could learn in law school as far as the actual law and how to practice it that you can't learn online at home. So what law school is really about is understanding that there are loopholes in everything and finding out how to spot them.
Yeah.
Fantastic loopholes and where to find them. I didn't say that because I think that this was long before the Fantastic Beasts movie had come out.
But that is
But
funny.
If I were in that conversation now, that's definitely how I would put it. So as I had mentioned, they never really enforced prohibition nationwide. And there's a quote that I found from a Democratic senator from the state of Maryland where they had the most trouble enforcing. Because from what I understand, in Maryland, they basically never made any effort at all to enforce prohibition. They just said, nope, we're not doing it. And so there's a quote from Senator William Cable Bruce. And he said, it can be truly said that, except to a highly qualified extent, it has never gone into practical effect at all. Which is a very articulate, well-educated way of saying, not doing it.
Like, we want a party, so...
Yeah, it's Maryland. Baltimore is here. We make Baltimore lemonade. It might have killed Edgar Allan Poe, but also his health was bad. You don't know.
Yeah.
Quick fun fact about Senator William Cable Bruce here. He actually won a Pulitzer Prize for a biography that he wrote about Benjamin Franklin.
Good for him.
So you won't find that at Flourish and Blotts, but check it out if you're the kind of person who enjoys historical biographies that won Pulitzer Prizes. Now, this is actually a little bit of a connection to today. People, I don't know if they have the Walgreens in other countries, but I think most people in the United States have heard of Walgreens. Y'all have heard of Walgreens, yes?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The pharmacy, the one that's always across the street from a, what is it? It's not Rite Aid, it's the other one. CVS.
CVS.
Yeah.
Yeah, for people who have never been to the United States of America, most people who go to an actual pharmacy have one of two choices. They either go to Walgreens or they go to CVS. And I don't know if this is a thing in other states, but it's definitely a thing in Kentucky and Indiana, where I've spent most of my life, where anytime they build a Walgreens, they build a CVS across the street or the other way around.
I mean,
and
yeah.
Somehow they don't seem to have any trouble being across the street from each other. I've never been able to figure that out.
I'm but Googling, why are Walgreens and CVS so close?
Yeah.
By setting up a shop near a competitor.
But the reason I bring up Walgreens is because this is one of those loopholes that we mentioned. Drugstores were still allowed to sell what they called medicinal whiskey, and it was used for everything from toothaches to the flu. That I have heard of, because a lot of times if you have a baby who's teething because their teeth are coming in, some people will say an old home remedy is you take a little bit of rum or whiskey and you just kind of lightly dab it on their gums. It helps them deal with the pain. I've also heard of whiskey being used if you have a flu, because some people will mix a beverage they call a hot toddy. It's supposed to help clear you out. And depending on the mix, it make you not care that you have the flu.
Oh, yeah. My great-grandma always just said, put some whiskey on it.
All right, if I took some whiskey every time that I felt sick, I'd be drunk right now. All the time, actually. I mean, I think everyone back then was drunk all the time.
Well, I mean, it was the 20s. There was some fun stuff going on, but there was a war before, there was a war ahead. Some people may or may not have known that. There was a depression going on that was pretty great. Not great in the sense that it was fun, but great in the sense that it was huge and it happened. But getting back to our list of fun facts about Prohibition.
This all sounds pretty relevant to me right now. So.
So a lot of speakeasies actually began operating under the guise of being a quote-unquote pharmacy. I did air quotes just now, not a visual podcast, so I had to describe it. Yeah. And this loophole is actually what helped to grow the chain Walgreens from 20 locations to more than 500. So something like 10 hours ago, we brought up Walgreens for the first time. That's why. Thanks to Prohibition and legal loopholes that allowed the sale of medicinal whiskey, that is what helped grow Walgreens. Booze.
So Walgreens and CVS are across from each other just to compete with each other, so that it's like, if you go to CVS and they don't have what you want, you can just go to Walgreens and they might have what you want. Or like you go to... You're like, I'm going to go to CVS, but then you see the sign in Walgreens window that's like, this is on sale. And you're like, oh, then I'll go over to Walgreens.
It's like the gas stations that like go across from each other and have the price wars on their signs.
Yeah.
Your petrol stations,
but
I think some people actually still call them.
One of the pharmacies, so that's where I'm going to shop.
So this next fact is actually a connection to the Fantastic Beasts films that some people may already be aware of, but speakeasies and dive bars where liquor was manufactured and sold during Prohibition were also referred to as blind pigs, which happens to be the name of the speakeasy that Newt, Tina, Jacob, and Queenie go to in the first film. Little spot called the Blind Pig.
It's a pretty cool fact. Very subtle of them.
I had a feeling that the name Blind Pig was important because I've seen too many behind the scenes looks at films not to know that a lot of times names like that usually are a reference to something. I didn't know that it was this.
Interesting.
Were either of you aware that speakeasies were called blind pigs?
I don't remember being aware of it.
I was not. Surprise me. Yeah. So I was not. And it's interesting because I see you know underneath also called blind tigers. We used to have.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. So let me ask you this. Since the main topic was what ifs, what if the speakeasy they went to was called the blind tiger? Would that have been as catchy?
No. But we used to have a blind tiger pub near me. And now I'm like making that connection. I'm like, oh, I get it now.
Yeah, I would have thought Blind Tiger was a weird name before I learned all these things. And now if I saw a place called the Blind Tiger, I would just think, oh, okay, somebody knows their history.
Yeah, I never got it before. Now I get it.
Yeah.
So when they ratified the 21st Amendment, which was the constitutional amendment that was passed to repeal prohibition, the first state to pass the 21st Amendment was Michigan, and the last state that was required, I believe it's 36 states that are required in order to ratify a constitutional amendment. And the 36th state, the last one they needed, was Utah. I found that interesting only because for some people who may not be aware, the state of Utah is well known for being a place where a large population of Mormons live. And I don't know if I don't know if this holds true for all people who come from Mormon families, but it's my understanding based on the people who come from Mormon families I've met that one of the principles that they hold is that they generally abstain from drinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a big thing.
So it's interesting that the last state to ratify the amendment repealing prohibition was Utah.
Yeah, that makes sense that a big population there wouldn't have been drinking anyway. So they're like, why bother?
Sure.
And then it was like, some of the people who live here want to drink. Okay.
Now, before we were talking about how in some states they just were not, like in Maryland, they were not enforcing prohibition at all.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you had some states that were not repealing it, that were heavily enforcing it even after the passage of the 21st Amendment, which repealed prohibition, because prohibition wasn't actually repealed in the state of Mississippi until 1966. So they were still enforcing it, and in some counties, not just in the state of Mississippi, but I believe in other states in the U.S. as well, there are still what's known as dry counties, where you cannot sell or purchase alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I think I may be wrong, because I don't live in a dry county. I don't think I ever have. But I believe that if you live in a dry county, there may also be laws about going outside the county to purchase alcohol and then bringing it in, even if you're not selling it.
Yeah. I know some states still have weird laws about where alcohol can be sold and what types.
Yeah, I was gonna say that.
So, like, I think it's like New Hampshire or something. You can't buy certain things in the grocery store. Like, you have to go to a liquor store.
Yeah, I've experienced that in different states, and then I'll move, and I'll be like, I'm gonna go get some alcohol, and then I'm like, I have to go to a different store?
I remember, I spent most of my life growing up in the state of Indiana, and I remember that for most of my life, you could not buy alcohol anywhere on Sundays. Liquor stores were closed every Sunday, and any places like Walmart or Walgreens or anywhere else that sold it commercially in bottles, they couldn't sell it to you until it was Monday again. And that led to two things. A lot of people stocking up on weekends so that if they wanted to have a drink on Sunday, they were prepared. or a lot of people going out to restaurants that serve cocktails, because that was the loophole to that. You couldn't buy it in a store, but if you went to a restaurant that had a bar and you wanted to buy alcohol there, you could still do it. And I remember a few years ago when I was in graduate school when they announced that statewide they were changing that law so that you could buy alcohol only between 12 p.m. EST and 8 p.m. EST in the state of Indiana. It was a huge deal. I have never... The people were freaking out about it, and I did not understand what the hype was. I was just old enough to go out and buy alcohol for myself if I so chose at that point, but even then, I just thought, is this really even a thing that people need to be excited about? Maybe I've just never really wanted to party as much as some other people have. I mean, I went through my late teens and early 20s like everyone else. I went through my phase of, hey, Jeff, we're having a party. You want to come?
Heck yeah, I want to come.
Yeah, I went through that. But even then and now, I couldn't get that excited about it. Mm-hmm. So just two more fun facts that I have here about Prohibition. There was actually a Prohibition party. There was an actual political party based around this idea of Prohibition, and their mascot was a camel. Don't know why.
That's so much.
Why do they no pick idea. Such strange animals for party mascots? Like, it's very odd. Wouldn't you think you'd want, like, I don't know. You think of, like, mascots for schools where, like, everyone wants, like, the one that's, like, the fiercest. And then, like, political parties are like, hey, I'm a camel, I'm an elephant, and I'm a donkey. It's very odd.
I just thought of Shrek when you said that. I've been turning it over in my mind, and the only explanation for why the Prohibition Party would use a camel that I can come up with is camels store water in their humps, and the Prohibition Party wants you to drink lots of water?
See, question I just mark? Think of, like, camel cigarettes. That I'm like, that doesn't make sense.
That too! They wanted a camel to sell not drinking, and then they turn around and use a camel to sell cigarettes. Which, by the way, they don't do that anymore.
Crazy. Yeah.
I feel Joe Camel billboards for camel cigarettes were everywhere. T-shirts were everywhere when I was growing up. And now, none of it. They don't even advertise anymore. But do they really have to?
Yeah, not really.
I don't think so.
I think if you're going to smoke, you're going to smoke, right?
Exactly. And there isn't even this huge media thing. We're getting off on a tangent, but it's okay. Tangents are magical and I adore them. People have always made this huge deal about images of cigarettes in movies and TV shows motivating kids to smoke, and in my experience, that's not what gets them to do it.
Hey, I grew up watching, like, I Love Lucy, where they're constantly smoking, and I've never had a cigarette, so I think yeah. I proved their theory wrong.
I've also never put a trophy on my head or begged to be on a TV show.
Yeah.
So no. Pick and choose which aspects of Lucy's life with Ricky to emulate.
I've also never thought it was a good idea to cook 6 pounds of rice either.
No, not unless you are cooking 6 pounds of rice in a pot the size of a large bathtub. And if you're cooking rice in a bathtub, I think you need to re-examine your priorities in life.
I think you have other issues at that point.
For sure. So my last fact, which is not going to be as much fun as the camel, but since I put it on the list, I'm just going to go ahead and round it off here by saying that the 18th Amendment that put Prohibition in place is the only amendment of the U.S. Constitution to be repealed. All other amendments to the U.S. Constitution, to my knowledge, are still in effect. The only one that has, I believe there have been efforts to repeal some of the other amendments of the Constitution, but the only one to be repealed is the 18th.
Because they were just so bad at it.
It wasn't accomplishing anything. It wasn't making anyone's lives better. Yeah. It was just putting money in Al Capone's pocket. By the way, if Al Capone could have showed up in the Fantastic Beasts movies just as a brief cameo, that would have been kind of fun. Like, they don't give him any lines, but they just kind of pass him in the street, and you know who it is.
He's just in the speakeasy.
He's the guy in the... He's got the suit, the hat, his coat's over his shoulders. He's not actually wearing it. He's got a cigar.
Because no one else in the 20s looked like that. I don't think Fantastic Beasts would have someone smoking a cigar. Like, well...
No, they have to smoke, like, some giant pipe in the shape of a dragon because they're not going to pretend smoking didn't exist, but they have to make it look as silly as they can.
Yeah, and, like, bad. I was going to be like, they'd have bad guys do it, but then I was like, I mean, I guess Al Capone is not a good guy.
He's just going to walk down the street with a skull hookah. That's fine.
Yeah.
I have had a vision.
Was the goblin, did he have a cigar?
It is time to share my vision of the future. This is my idea of what Al Capone sounds like.
Yeah, Narlacc has...
Narlacc.
He has a cigar, I think.
Did have a cigar. So that was all. Everything I said doesn't make sense.
Oh, please. He didn't have a cigar. He had a cigar butt. Like, he'd been chewing on that cigar since... He'd been chewing on that cigar since they were still in pre-production on the film.
It was a CGI cigar. But also, he's not really a good guy. He had a cigar to show, like, he's shady. The good guys are never going to smoke in the movies because they're the good guys.
Oh, and... yeah. At best, an anti-hero might have a cigarette during the mission because life is hard and anti-heroes are gritty, but we don't have anti-heroes in this franchise.
Can you imagine if Loot, like, because realistically, they all would have been smoking all the time. Can you imagine if Loot had just been smoking through the whole movie? That would have been so weird.
Oh, gosh, no. Loot would have been the only person in the platoon not smoking. Like, everybody else would have been smoking if you got him, and Newt would have been the guy saying, you do understand that smoking is very hazardous to your health.
Yeah. Don't smoke
around
the animals.
And the health of the creatures.
He would have been like Jeffrey Rush in The King's Speech. Well, I believe that inhaling smoke into your lungs, it will kill you.
Well, for our podcast question this week, it has nothing to do with alcohol, but I guess it's more of a statement than a question. So you can answer any of our what ifs that we discussed. We kind of had these built-in 6 questions for you, or send us your own what if that we or the other hosts can discuss on the next episode, the episodes after that, in another main discussion. So yeah, just think about what if something else had happened in Fantastic Beasts or hadn't happened. And you can drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets, or you can email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. And don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. We have good reviews on iTunes, but we'd love more. We'd always love more.
Yeah, I love reading the reviews on iTunes. They always make me smile because it's nice to know that the podcast is actually doing something
for
people. You
know, and even some of the bad reviews make me smile.
Oh, who doesn't love a good bad review?
Yeah,
even bad
like,
reviews they're fun to read.
Yeah. A lot of times bad reviews are like, well, I don't want you to be listening to our show. Like, if you don't like the show, stop listening to it. I don't want you to listen to the show. Like, for your health. For your peace of mind. I don't want you to listen to something that you don't like. Like, I don't listen to things I don't like. So.
That's just too easy, Shannon.
Yeah, I know.
Too much logic.
Do not listen to a podcast if it does not spark joy.
If the podcast does spark joy and you want to talk to us about it, if you want to share your thoughts about our podcast question of the week, if you want to share any other thoughts you have about the episode in general, if you want to clarify any of the facts about Prohibition that we shared during our time turner, then you can contact us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SpeakBeastie. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/SpeakBeastie. We are on Tumblr at speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com. Or You can join our wonderful group of Patreon supporters by supporting the show on Patreon at patreon.com/speakbeastie. By doing so, you can gain access to bonus material that we've been working on. You can also collect some of our very cool stickers. We have great stickers that are rolling out.
Yeah.
I have a great collection of stickers. I keep them inside my Fantastic Beasts film book. I love them.
I love stickers.
And our group of Patreon supporters also gain access to the Speak Beastie. Is it the Speak Beastie Common Room?
Yes. If you're high enough tier. I think that's if you are the $5 tier.
We do fun things in there. Sometimes we get together, we play Among Us online, or every now and then we'll just kind of get together for a good old chat on Skype. It's just, it's a fun group of people to know. It's a great group of people to talk to. I really love it. I'm Jeff.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Shannon. Case closed.